Welcome to Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've just finished a New York Times bestselling book by a New York Times number one bestselling author and Pulitzer Prize winner, John Meacham, who's written a book called Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. And there's a local connection. George Bush did his naval flight training, began his naval flight training right here in Chapel Hill. And I've asked Bob Epting, our friend and lawyer, who spends a lot of time on that same field, to talk to us a little bit, or with us, with John Meacham, about George Bush's time in Chapel Hill. John Meacham, thank you. I know you're busy. Congratulations on another great best-selling book. How do you do?
Well, thank you for having me. Delighted to be back with you.
Most of the public attention to your book has come at, based on the President George H.W. Bush's comments about the staff or the team that his son assembled as president. And so I read and read in the book. I didn't get to it. And finally, in the last 15 pages, I got to that. And that, were you surprised that some of the public attention to your book has been focused on those last 15 pages?
Honestly, no. That's the wages of having been a journalist for a long time. I remember the October afternoon in 2008 when President Bush started in on this particular subject. I remember thinking, those are the headlines of the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I knew right then.
Where were you all? Where were you all talking? Where were you? You were in Texas.
We were in his office. We were in his office in Houston on a Monday morning. I'll never forget it. Right before the 2008 election, and we were really beginning. We had done some interviews before, some conversations, but we had decided to wait until the end of his son's presidency to begin in earnest. And it was very late in October, and he started making his comments about Cheney and Rumsfeld and how he felt that both Cheney and Rumsfeld had contributed to, had exacerbated the hawkish tone around 43's administration that Bush Sr. thought was unfortunate. And no kidding, I was sitting right there thinking that was almost, 7 years ago, almost exactly. And he repeated the point in different ways, underscored it in a series of conversations in ensuing years. And so this wasn't a drive-by comment. It was not something that he just said one day and moved on. The other thing about it, I just want to say, because I think it's interesting for people who are interested in history, I went back to President Bush in December of last year and said, if you want to, I can't take this off the record, obviously, but if you want to say that you said this in the heat of the moment, but had different views now, that I would note that. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, that's what I said. So he clearly wanted this on the record.
Well, so you knew that you knew better than I did that this would be the part of the book, even though it comes at the last, that would be getting the headline attention.
Part of it is one of the reasons I wanted to do the book is I wanted George H.W. Bush to have his own moment and not simply be seen as precursor to his sons or as an epilogue to Ronald Reagan, but as his own figure, as his own man who had his hour upon the stage, acquitted himself, I think, incredibly well when you look back on it. Not a perfect president by any means, but we haven't had one of those yet. And so I wanted this story of the last president of the greatest generation, first president of the post-Cold War world, a man who brought an end to the Cold War without a shot being fired. I wanted him to have a full dress telling of his story.
When you summarize the first President Bush's accomplishments, as you just did, do you think he's gotten sort of a raw deal in terms of his evaluation as a president when you, even though he only had one term and was not reelected, that's a lot of good things that got done under his under his watch?
I think early on, I think obviously whenever you are defeated for re-election, that's a fairly strong judgment. The country decided not to rehire him and functionally fired him. And so obviously there was unhappiness with him in real time. But one of the interesting things about Bush and about his public record is, and about the public's view of him, I should say, was almost instantly after he was defeated, his approval rating started rising. And so he went out, I think I'm right, at about 51 or 52% approval rating, which for a president who had just gotten 37% of the vote was a pretty remarkable accomplishment. It's almost as though the country was in a fever about wanting to change presidents, about wanting to change course. And once the fever broke, I think people began to see anew what they had had with Bush as president. My own view is that he was a important domestic president, though no one, including him, would have thought that, or thought that many people would have said it back in 1992 when he lost. But when you look with this perspective of history and not just the heat of journalism, you find that he passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. He passed the Clean Air Act, which is still functionally our environmental policy. He passed the 1990 budget deal, which cost him dearly, but which Bill Clinton will tell you at length, although that's redundant, I guess, set the terms for the prosperity of the 1990s. And again, I'm not saying that this is St. George of Kenny Bunkport by any means, but I am saying that when the decades fall away and you look back without the passions of the moment and you try to look at it with a kind of fair-minded historical sensibility, George H.W. Bush does very well indeed.
One of the parts of your book that struck me the hardest, I think, was the emergence of Newt Gingrich into the political picture during the time that that Vice President Bush and then President Bush were in operation, bringing together in hard and fast dissent from the Washington establishment, including both Republicans and Democrats, that it sort of the origins of the divide that divides the country today. Does President Bush, as you talked to the first President Bush, as you talked to him, harbor any strong feelings about that, the rise of the Gingrich-type Republicans in Washington during the time that President Bush was there?
Yes, he does. He wouldn't be human if he didn't. You know, in his mind, he was the head of the party, the Republican president, duly elected. He had won a term in 1988, which a lot of people said wasn't possible. He was the first sitting vice president to succeed a president of his own party since Martin Van Buren succeeded Andrew Jackson back in 1836. So it had taken 152 years. To replicate what Bush had done. And yes, I mean, he was unhappy, remains unhappy with the Republicans who bolted and turned on him when he changed the Read My Lips broke it. He's quite direct about the fact that it was an act, direct quotation from him, it was an actual breach of his word. And he took that very, very seriously. But he believed that sound governance, as he put it, sometimes required breaking one's word, and sometimes required breaking of a campaign pledge. And that's what he did. He understandably understood why the very conservative members of his party did what they did. But that doesn't mean he liked it.
We're visiting with John Meacham about his latest best-selling book, Destiny and Power. This is the biography of George Herbert Walker Bush. John Meacham and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Mitchum, who's the author of already the best-selling book, Destiny and Power. This is the American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. I'm being joined here in Chapel Hill by Bob Epting. We're going to talk about George Herbert Walker Bush's time in Chapel Hill in just a little bit. But first, John, you had a what I would say is a challenging assignment, and that is to write the biography of an important president who is still alive. You've had great success writing about presidents like Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, where you didn't have the advantages of being able to talk to the presidents, nor did you have the disadvantages maybe of having them having to feel like you had some obligation to them. Mm-hmm. What are the ups or the advantages and disadvantages of writing about a living person?
Well, you put it very well. The advantage is, if I were wondering about something, I could call him up and say, do you remember anything about this moment with Mikhail Gorbachev? Do you remember how you felt about Gingrich? Whatever it would be. The disadvantage, as you say, is that politicians, by their very nature, are charming people. That the fundamental political transaction in a democracy is a politician convincing you to entrust your fate to their hands. And so I had an enormous amount of access to President Bush, to his diaries, to Mrs. Bush, to Mrs. Bush's diaries, to President Bush 43, who was incredibly generous with his time. We spent a lot of time together. And so the peril is you get too close to your subject. And it's always a peril in biography. It can happen with a long dead subject as well. It's a particularly live peril when it's someone who's alive and someone who has so many people around him who love him so much. So what I had to do at the end of this long project, I first met him 17 years ago. I started interviewing him 9 years ago and wrote in earnest for the last 3 years or so. What I had to do at the very end of the project was look at what I had done coldly and as dispassionately as possible and convince myself, be secure in my own head and heart, that I had gotten as close to the truth as I could, and that includes the good and the bad. And readers will have to judge whether I succeeded. I believe, without reservation, that I wrote as fair and honest-minded a book as I could.
In your, not your epilogue, but in your credits, you give enormous credit to the prior biographers of President Bush. And really, it's such a generous, it was so nice to hear the compliments coming from one biographer to another, saying that he really got so much from the prior biographies. In any event, in light of your charitable comments about the earlier biographies, what did you get accomplished and what did you share with us that the earlier biographies missed?
I think less of what they missed, but more that I was coming to the project, to the subject, at the point where I believe that a fuller historical evaluation is best possible, most possible. And so the earlier books, which are wonderful, and I commend them to readers, were coming earlier. Some had access to him, some did not. I was able to have access to him, to his diary. I'm the first biographer to have access to Mrs. Bush's diary, which stretches back to 1948. I'm the first who actually listened to the diaries themselves, didn't just read transcripts, because they were audio diaries. So I think it's all of those tributaries formed a river that became my book. And it might not be as deep a river as I think it is. And again, that's for readers to judge. But this was coming, you know, previous biographies that came, say, 5 years or 6 years after President Bush's presidency, you know, it's just a different perspective because time creates perspectives on presidents that enable us to see things more clearly. And I think any historian would agree with that. And so I like to think that this is the most intimate portrait of the president. I was able to spend more time with him than any other previous biographer, and was able to spend more time with the diaries, frankly, than others. But it's not a competitive situation. I believe that there's a historical conversation that unfolds, and this is the beginning of the real historical conversation about George Bush. It's not the end. It's not the last word. I don't use the word definitive. I don't think there is such a thing, really, as a definitive biography, because the very nature of biography is it's all subject to human shadings and human failings and human successes. And so every biographer brings something particular to the task, and I look forward to my successors in this field of endeavor.
Well, for those who will not take time to read the book, what would be the things that you would tell them about George W. Bush that you have that you have shared with us in the you know, the 600 pages of text and lots of notes and background material that you shared? What is it important for us as American citizens to know about this important president?
I think the thing that surprised me the most, and I think will surprise readers, is how emotional a man this was. Sometimes he seemed to be this button-down wasp who had just stepped out of the Brooks Brothers catalog. He was, as his speechwriter Christopher Buckley once said, a man with the tear ducts of a Sicilian grandmother. You know, he was very sensate, very tactile. Bill Clinton said he felt our pain. I think George Bush did. He just didn't know how to show it particularly well. He had the vices of his virtues, so his dignity, which in some cases was a gift to the country, in some ways hurt him politically because he was someone who became awkward or silent at particularly emotional moments. So I think that part of his life is important. I think the road to the presidency is something that bears attention. His World War II experience, being shot down in the Pacific, losing a daughter to leukemia in the 1950s, his persistence in politics after, you know, he lost more than he won in terms of a big campaign, but he kept after it. He was driven by an ambition to win, to succeed, as he put it, to be number one, and also a devotion to service. And so these two engines, if you will, drove him all his life, drove him to the pinnacle. And I think in many ways this is a study in the tension between ambition and duty, drive and service.
You mentioned several times in your book that President Bush, in trying himself to explain what drove him to be so ambitious and to covet the presidency so much, he said something like, and correct me if I'm wrong, he said something like, you know, I feel like I want to be captain. I feel like, yeah, I'm the best person to lead, and so I want to lead. And yeah, is that true? And is there more to it? Was it more to it than just I'm running for student body president for president of the United States because I like to lead and I think I'm good at it?
Well, I think there is more. I think he did have a governing philosophy. He was functionally a moderate Republican. He was the last Eisenhower Republican in many ways, but to some extent, it was a very personalized view of leadership. It was that he believed that the country and the world would be better in his hands than in the other guys. And it's as primal and fundamental as that. And again, it's not a kind of primal and fundamental view that a lot of people would think or ascribe to George Bush, I think. I think a lot of people saw him as sort of a distant gentleman. And he was a gentleman, unquestionably. But he was driven perennially to shape the lives of others. He wanted power. He wanted power because he thought that he could wield that power in a constructive way in the cause of America and of the world. And we have to judge him on what he did. You know, what did he do once he amassed that power? In my view, given the end of the Cold War, given the execution of the Gulf War, given the way he managed the Chinese relationship after Tiananmen Square, given Panama, is that he repaid the American trust, the trust that Americans put in it.
We're visiting with John Meacham. We're talking about his latest book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our guest is John Meacham. He is the author of Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. John, you've had incredible access to the papers and the person of President Bush. In some respects, the president himself has not written his autobiography. You've done it for him, and that the words are mostly his. Or and that's not fair. There, much of the book is quotes from his diary or quotes from him. So have you just become his mouthpiece?
I don't think he would share the judgment that I made on his conduct of the office. I don't think he would say that he had failed rhetorically in terms of explaining what he did to the country. I don't think he would have acknowledged misleading the public on Iran-Contra, which I believe he did, and I argue that he did. I don't think he would have, in an autobiography, have seen the 1988 campaign as a hard-hitting race that was at times not worthy of his essential character. So, I don't think so. I do draw on the diary significantly because it's a unique historical document. This book is the means by which a president's real-time audio diary reflections on what it was actually like to be president. To some extent, I felt an obligation to put as much of that on the record as I possibly could. I do plan to edit volumes of the diaries for publication president's gone. But I don't think this is the autobiography that he didn't write. I think that it's a historian's view, well, a biographer's view anyway, of his life, what shaped him, and what he meant to all of us. And again, readers will have to decide.
You mentioned two incidents of what might have been, you're having a different, more critical perspective than President Bush, and one of them is the Iran-Contra situation. And I thought this was one of the best parts of the book because it raised the conflict that George H.W. Bush must have felt by being a loyal vice president and a loyal member of a team in a situation where he might have done differently had he been in charge. But by being a loyal team player, he might not have been loyal to his duty as a to his conscience and also as a representative of the people.
Well, he was wrong about Iran-Contra. He was wrong about the Iran initiative, which was an arms sales deal to reach out to Iranian moderates. President Reagan was for it. George Bush was for it. Successive national security advisors were for it. George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger, the Secretaries of State and Defense, were against it. Shultz and Weinberger were right. Reagan, Bush, and the successive national security advisors were wrong. Then, at a critical moment when the story began to break, Bush said it was crazy to think that we would sell arms for hostages when, in fact, that's what we were doing. And he knew that. Now, he got with the program pretty fast and became an advocate for getting the truth out. But the world cannot, I mean, we can't ignore the fact that at least initially he said that what was so was not so. Now, in a long political life of a half century now, 1964 was his first race for the Senate. You're going to have moments like this. I can't think of a significant American president who did not have a moment where they shaded the truth or skirted the truth. That's simply the nature of public life. But we can't ignore it. And I think actually it makes them more interesting rather than less interesting, because it shows, you know, that tension again between the drive to win and his duty to serve and to his view of the national interest.
No, I agree completely. I think it's an important part for all of us who have an interest in public service to read. But let me just ask you this. Do you think he would have handled it differently had he actually been the president rather than a member of the president's staff, as he viewed his role?
Yes. I mean, would he as president have authorized an operation like this? I don't know. He certainly had an opportunity at various points to oppose it. He probably would not have, without getting too deep in the weeds on this particular issue, because for various reasons, we were working through Israel. He knew as CIA director that when you had a covert operation, you needed as much control as possible. And by having a third party, by having a third country involved, you lost a certain amount of control. He would have had a more well-organized National Security Council process than President Reagan did at that point. So this particular policy probably would not have taken root in a Bush administration, and did not, in point of fact. But, you know, what they were trying to do is quite familiar to us, right? They were trying to find a way to deal with Iran. Mark Twain once said, history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And it certainly rhymes in this case, because President Obama is doing the same thing.
Right. Well, speaking of the history repeating itself, I wonder if you see any comparisons to make between the political campaigns that President Bush encountered and those which his son Jeb is participating in now. Are there? Do you ever watch some of these guys talk and say, "Well, that's just almost exactly what happened to his dad," or "That's just almost"?
Oh, you know, it really is. Oh, it's amazing. I mean, here you have a populist billionaire who's totally complicating and flummoxing a Bush, which is what happened with Ross Perot and George Bush. Now, it happened Bush 41 in the general election, but Trump and Perot have represent similar strains in the American political life. Governor Bush is a lot like his father in that he seems to be more moderate than the more conservative base of the party. He's got opponents in the primary who are quite willing to point that out. He's got opponents in the primary who argue against the dynastic touch. I mean, even though George H.W. Bush was the first Bush of the three who have now run for president, he was the son of a senator. He was a sitting vice president. He was seen as a blue blood. And so his opponents always argued that he had, you know, functionally been born on third base, but thought he'd hit a triple, you know. So, yes, I mean, this is all somewhat familiar. And that's one reason that, you know, as we sit here in, long before Iowa, I wouldn't count Jeb Bush out, because Bushes tend to win the races they enter. And they always have a rough time in the primary. Even George W. lost New Hampshire quite soundly to John McCain in 2000. So, it's still a long way to go. It looks pretty bleak right now, to be sure, but there's still a long way to go.
I thought about Jeb Bush and his, inadequate performances in the debate, sometimes sort of sitting and pouting, and compared to your description of the New Hampshire primary debates between first Ronald Reagan and George Bush, that George Bush sort of sat there seemingly without energy or without any kind of emotion, and Jeb sort of did the same thing in one of the recent debates.
No, it's true. There is a famous debate in 1980 in Nashua, New Hampshire, in which Reagan surprises Bush by bringing the other candidates onto stage, and Bush reacted very poorly. He admitted it to me. He said it was, as he put it, not my finest hour, to say the least. He was angry. A conservative opponent of his had stopped him in the hallway on his way to the stage. All sorts of human reasons why this happened. But it was a very, it was an iconic moment for every presidential debate. When CNN does its retrospective, there are pictures of this. It's the moment at which Reagan grabbed the microphone and said, "I'm paying for this microphone." I'm sure your politically attuned listeners all know the moment well. And Bush looked like, as William Loeb, who was the editor of the conservative Manchester Union Leader, said, like a little boy whose mother had dropped him off at the wrong birthday party.
Wow.
So is that happening to Jeb now? It's hard to say, but it's a... I will say this, 2016 has sort of blown up all historical analogies.
Right.
So I hesitate to draw parallels just because it's such a topsy-turvy year.
We're visiting with John Meacham. We're talking about his latest book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about President Bush's time in Chapel Hill. Stick with us. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Meacham. We're talking about his latest book, Destiny and Power, which is subtitled The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. And a lot of people, I think, don't know that George Bush spent a short time in Chapel Hill, but a very significant time. John, can you tell us about how the
absolutely,
Chapel Hill experience
absolutely.
Fit?
Yeah, he, on his 18th birthday... let's take one step back. He thought about joining the Royal Canadian Air Force in December of 1941 after Pearl Harbor, because you didn't have to go to college, you didn't have to graduate from high school to get into that program. He was talked into waiting. He was a senior in high school at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. On his 18th birthday, June 12, 1942, he graduated from high school, turned 18, and drove to Boston to become a naval enlistee. In his first posting, his father dropped him off at Penn Station for the train downward, was to flight training in Chapel Hill. He wrote very detailed letters about it. It was a very, shaping experience for him. It was a memorable experience because it was his first time away from home, first time away from prep school, first time he'd actually met many Americans from different walks of life. In the letters home, he talks about how important little things become when you're in the military, wanting to get a kind word from your instructor or a Coke at the end of the day. And there was one other thing I'll say about Chapel Hill. There was a very sweet scene of a girl he had met. He met up with a girl that he had first encountered at a Christmas dance at the Greenwich Country Club for a day in Chapel Hill. Her name was Barbara Pierce. History would hear much more about her in the ensuing years. So when I took Mrs. Bush some of these letters, she was struck to remember that she had actually been allowed to go see him by herself, unchaperoned. She said, "My, we were awfully advanced, weren't we?" In her memory, she'd been chaperoned for that. So Chapel Hill was a critical stopping off place for the beginning of the Odyssey of George Bush's.
Well, it's a strong marriage. We can't say it started in Chapel Hill, but it sure took a big step forward in Chapel Hill. You talk about the Carolina Inn and walking to Kenan Stadium. But Bob, tell us a little bit. Bob Epting, tell us a little bit about what the naval program, air program was, and who else was involved in it.
The Naval Pre-Flight Program at Chapel Hill, as at many universities around the country, was a program really designed not to teach pilots to fly, but to sort out the ones who weren't going to have the aptitude to fly. Most pilots who spend any time in the cockpit know that some folks simply their inner ear balance and other parts of their physical mechanisms simply don't suit them to control an airplane in the sky. And the pre-flight program here was a program conducted with all of the training was in small Piper Cub airplanes. And the smallest and most basic airplane even today that somebody can fly. It had a tail wheel and not a nose wheel. And people still say today that if you fly the nose wheel, you fly the plane with the wheel on the wrong end. But that program here at Chapel Hill trained more than 15,000 pilots who went into the Naval Service for World War II. I never knew exactly when he came until I saw in John's book that it was the summer of 1942, a critical time in World War II, both in terms of naval operations and the plan to resecure the Pacific, which was greatly at risk up until that time. And so our program here was extremely important. It was done with platoons of about 25 men each, and those classes came through and stayed. John, correct me if I'm wrong, I think about 12 weeks each. And in that 12 weeks' time, you had programs, book learning, navigation and equipment and other things, but you also had strenuous physical training activities. That's where when the Navy pool was built. It was when Navy fields, where the Carolina football team practices today, were built. Everything essentially south of Raleigh Road was built by the Navy in those days. So a huge contribution to Chapel Hill and to the University of North Carolina.
John Engine, what did the Chapel Hill experience do? I guess that George Bush passed and was qualified to be a pilot and then went on for further training, but it was kind of unusual. He was maybe the youngest person in his class, the youngest pilot. So he must have.
He was thought to be when he got his wings in Corpus Christi. He went on to, I won't get all the places right, but he would go on to Minneapolis. He would go on to a couple of places, Hyannisport, I think. Had several different stops along the way after Chapel Hill, after he did pass, as Bob described, the aptitude. And then was commissioned as part of a squadron, VT-51, I think it was, that was assigned to the carrier San Jacinto. That was commissioned, actually, in Philadelphia in late 1943. So he had over a year of training, which makes sense given the complexities of flying in combat. I can barely drive a car, so I can only imagine what it's like to do that. But he sometimes described as a fighter pilot, which is not quite right. He was a bomber pilot, a torpedo bomber, a big slow plane. It, for those who go, and I recommend it to the Bush Library in College Station over at Texas A&M, there's a bomber like the one he flew hanging from the library ceiling. And it was not a fast plane. His job was to bomb and get out fast. And when he was shot down on September 2nd, 1944, that plane was lost, obviously. He lost three planes, one in training, one in the Pacific, and then one when he was shot down. But he won the Distinguished Flying Cross for his heroism at Chichijima. He was hit, so it saw fire go along the wings, the cockpit filled with smoke, but he kept going, and he took out a Japanese tower, which was the target and had been the target for 2 days. Chichijima was well fortified, heavy Japanese black. When he was out in the sea in a life raft waiting to be picked up by a U.S. submarine, which was on what was called lifeguard duty, he was, if the wind and the tide had blown him back toward the island,
he could have been
captured.
John,
yeah, he would have been POW.
I hate to interrupt you, but the time's up, but this is one of the most stirring stories in your book, and I encourage everybody to read it about George Bush's near captivity after he was downed. Thanks to Bob Epting and to John Meacham especially for sharing with us the stories about George Bush and a little bit of the history of Chapel Hill. Thanks to both of you. And thanks to all of you all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.